All right. Thanks for joining the Cannabis Podcast. I appreciate you. I'd like to introduce.
Morning. Good afternoon.
Will Stoke. Nice to meet you officially. Everybody, I'm
nice
sure
to
you
meet you, my friend. How's life? You well?
I'm doing well. Can't complain. You know, like we said, I'm breathing another day here. And you know, it's sunny outside, so can't really complain.
Like a tropical monsoon where I am right now.
So no beach day, no beach today.
No surfing today. No. I do live right next to one of the best surf breaks in the world, and that's why I live here. So yes, but no surf today.
For as long as I've lived in, I was born in Long Beach. For as long as I lived there, I'm really don't surf much, and I probably should do more than that, you know. But now that I'm in Austin, it's kind of land surfing now. So, but dude. Great to meet you finally. One of the big cannabis advocates in the world, in Australia, made some headlines recently in the last few years. Want to introduce you to our audience if they don't know you, which I'm sure they do. But tell us who you are and tell us about what you are about with cannabis. Appreciate you.
My name's Will Stolk. I am a former professional freestyle and big mountain snow skier. I started smoking cannabis when I was probably about 15 years old, going to summer camp in Whistler in Canada, heavily influenced by British Columbian and NorCal cannabis culture. A lot of my favorite skiers that I grew up watching used a lot of iconography of like Rastafarianism and kind of smoking weed in their video parts. That was pretty influential on me as a child. My parents didn't really smoke weed, but my dad had friends, I remember when I was a kid, that he told me had gone to jail for growing naughty plants. Obviously these weren't like very good friends of his, but you know, like friends. So, you know, it was around, but it wasn't ever really like put in my face. My dad was little bit of a hippie. He, you know, moved to Europe in the 70s to go skiing, and you know, he was a national champion water skier. So I grew up where I grew up in Sydney. I grew up around a lot of Hinduistic culture, I guess, surfing and kind of, you know, a lot of partying and stuff like that. So yeah, I've been a big cannabis kind of consumer since I was probably about 15 or 16. And then slowly but surely, after, you know, being on the Freeride tour and traveling around the world, getting paid to do photo shoots and film shoots and chasing, you know, chasing snow and also chasing lots of chicks and just being a little hoodlum, I got into cannabis. As a kid, you know, we would smoke, you know, 2 to 3 ounces a week between us when we were deep in it. And, you know, when you're in New Zealand or you're in some fucking weird country in Europe or you're in South America, you go on some pretty crazy journeys to try and get weed. And through those experiences, I met some of my best friends in the world. And one of those people is a gentleman named Corey Zeiler, who I now co-own a cannabis dispensary with in California, in a place called Lee Vining, which is at the bottom of Yosemite National Park, about 30 miles from Mammoth. And we also now own two flower companies, one called Pheno Hunts and one called Zero to Hero, a CBD company. And, you know, basically that's how I got into cannabis entrepreneurialism, was through just years and years of chasing snow. And then when it, on the downtime, trying to get on to get, you know, to get weed.
Nice. That was where, when you were like 15, 16, were you smoking out of pop cans? Or were you smoking out of glass? Or
first time I ever smoked, probably, you know, I smoked once when I was probably like 13. And we went surfing at this place, and it was probably about 4 or 5 foot, and it seemed like it was like 8 to 10 foot. It was pretty trippy. I still remember that quite vividly. My mate had a plant in his, because his dad had broken up with his mom. And so his dad was pretty, like, didn't really care. So he let him grow a weed plant. This was when we were in like grade 7. So I remember smoking weed out of a little. And then the next time was at summer camp in Whistler with a friend of mine. And we went to the block in Whistler, the famous block, and we bought an eighth. And then we went, was on a rainy day or on a down day. We went to the hotel where High North was, which is a famous ski camp back then. And we sat there and we smoked and ate through the apple. And then my mate ate the apple and he had little dreadlocks, like ratty dreadlocks, looked like a little weasel. And he got so high. I don't know if he got high from the apple, but that's what we thought. And ever since then, I've been pretty much been a pothead. So that was pretty much the one of the iconic moments of my childhood that led me down this path of hedonism.
Nice. Yeah, that's sounds very similar to mine. I was born in Long Beach, but moved to Ohio when I was like 6 or 7. When I was about 13, my sister had a party. She's older. Had some older friends over and they were like, hey, you want to, come smoke some weed? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? The first bowl I smoked didn't get me high, nothing, 13, whatever. Like 30 minutes later, went back outside. I was like, yeah, why not? I was on the moon. And I think like my body didn't recognize it yet or something. And then the second time, like a half hour later, I was just like, this is the greatest thing I've ever experienced ever. And pretty much since 15, 16, I was a skater, snowboarder, all that stuff. So very similar, just smoking, skating, riding bikes around the neighborhood, and pretty much been smoking and consuming ever since. So
yeah, there's a lot more little details in there, but that's basically the basics. It's it's just it and action sports culture, surfing, a lot of it's pretty familiar with cannabis and kind of heroes and what's the word for it? Hellmen is what surfing calls them. People that were larger than life. And those kind of iconic characters were around in my life a lot, rock stars and a lot of different people that I don't really want to name drop. But so a lot of that culture was really impactful on me as a child. And I was very much brought up to be an independent thinker and to kind of come to my own conclusions and to kind of not really give a fuck about what the establishment or my friends or what the popular narrative was. I always had my own kind of way of doing things. Obviously, that can be impactful on your life because obviously, as the Japanese proverb says, that the nail that sticks out gets hammered in. But my rebuttal to that was always be made a diamond and break the hammer. And diamonds are formed under pressure. So
of years and years of pressure.
And years of trying to get weed and get good weed in all these random places all over the world. Like I have been on so many fucking missions to try and get pot. It's fucking ridiculous. I've almost died. I've had guns pulled on me. I've been chased down the street in fucking hoods in strange places in South America and all sorts of shit, all because I wanted to get stoned. And kids now, they're really lucky that they've got access to such good weed so easily.
Yep. Because of people like yourself and the other activists that have come before us, doing the little work and the major work that they can.
I think I don't know about so much myself, but more so we sit on the shoulders of giants. People like the guys like Mark Emery, the guys that created Normal, the dudes that originally started High Times magazine, guys like Arian, the king of cannabis dude. All of that culture was, that was what the pillars that we have kind of built this brick wall of I wonder what's going to go happen in the future. I am part Dutch. I'm half Dutch. I have a Dutch passport. So I did go to Amsterdam quite a few times as a child. Obviously, my dad wasn't a pothead, but we'd walk past the cafes and past the red light district and he'd tell me what was what. And, he'd just explain and we went and had a look inside and stuff like that. I do remember that when I was probably like 13. I remember like they kind of ushered us out, but he just wanted to show me why, and explain to me why the rules were the way they were. And in Australia, it was different. And, all that kind of iconography as a child really inspired to me to lead a life of anti-establishment.
I'm very the same. My parents are not, very different than yours, but I'm kind of the counter narrative guy too. If everybody's going this way, I go that way. And they say, don't touch the stove, I touch the stove. So that's awesome. You had to go on all those missions because the government made it so impossible to buy a plant. And I find that ridiculous.
Pretty much, but then also weed culture, you know, weed culture has been prominent in, you know, California, British Columbia, maybe in certain parts of Quebec, you know, maybe Vermont had a little bit of a hippie culture on the East Coast. But in general, a lot of this cannabis culture came from California originally, and the hippie movement of when, you know, when the kind of after Berkeley and Ashbury and everybody moved up north into Humboldt and into Grass Valley and into the Emerald Triangle. And but that kind of, I guess originally it probably started with before the Beatniks was the hash smoking jazz musicians of the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. That was kind of, I think, probably the beginnings of all of this culture that we now see in society, in my opinion. There might have been other influences, but I think at the early days of counterculture, you know, it was the black dudes that were smoking hash, and you know, there was, and then obviously the Rolling Stones were inspired by that, et cetera, et cetera. And but you know, blah 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 blah. And now mm-hmm. we are here, you know, 70 years later, and still a large majority of the world aren't allowed to grow or consume a plant, as you just said.
It's the more I research it, and even rereading the same things, it blows my mind every time I read more. I'm like, this is insane. It is a plant. It's a plant. I don't get it. But I mean, it's in America. I don't know about Australia. In the pharmacology here, they used it before they outlawed it, you know, in
there was like millions and millions of acres. I can't remember the quote, but it was millions and millions of acres of the United States was dedicated to growing hemp pre-World War II and for World War II. The majority, all the uniforms, all the Hessian bags, a lot of supply bags, etc., were all made from hemp. One of your founding fathers, your first president, George Washington, he was a hemp grower. Same with Thomas
Jefferson,
Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. All these people that founded your whole country, they all grew hemp. You know, Queen Victoria in the 1800s, this is, you know, similar time frame, maybe a little 100 years later, she was an avid user of cannabis to treat her ailments in a medicinal way. You know, so for thousands of years, people have been using it in medicine, and really, you know, the whole movement of, you know, DuPont and DuPont Rope and all the... what was the back in the day, the marijuana madness?
Reefer madness.
Yeah, that first, when did that come out? In like 52 or something like that?
Produced by Harry Anslinger.
That was the beginnings of this, you know, anti-drug kind of sentiment that America sets the policy really for the rest of the Western world. It is what it is. America is still the cultural center of the Western world, and probably will be for a long time going forward, even though your country is falling apart, hence why you probably moved to Austin from California.
Bingo.
So, you know, it's an interesting thing what's going on in the world. We are starting to see a lot of progression. You know, Germany just legalized like 4 or 5 days ago, which is a really big step, because they're the country that sets the narrative for the rest of Europe, which is massive. I don't agree. I guess they've done it in the Bud Club way, like they have in Spain, which isn't that commercially viable for someone like myself that wants to expand into those territories. But as a consumer, which is what I do all this activism for, is for the consumer or for the medical patient, it's fantastic that we're jumping in leaps and bounds towards a brighter, greener future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Germany seems to be it is the economic center of, you know, Europe, and them doing that is a huge, huge step. And, you know, you were talking about Queen Victoria, JFK is known to have smoked weed for his back and all that stuff. And in the early 1700s, when we were still a commonwealth under the British crown, it was mandated by the crown that we had to grow a portion of our land, had to be hemp for the commonwealth. And then that went away, you know, for whatever reason. So it's apparently, you know, it's under an international treaty. an international treaty of narcotics or something like that, that was done under the UN, United States leadership. Like
that's exactly what it is. And it's to do with the trade of opiates and different pharmaceutical based drugs and how they're bought and processed and then sold over international borders. And that's why there's been a lot of technical issues for Germany legalizing, was obviously because of the European Union and then mandates that they'd signed as a country under the UN resolutions. And a lot of people don't understand that. And that's interesting that you do know that, because I have had conversations about with informed people, not necessarily myself, that have talked about that and having to, you know, you've got to go higher and higher in order to be able to change the policy of the whole world.
Yep. And it's interesting you say it that way, because I said that. I was like, okay, even if the United States did legalize it, that doesn't change the international treaty. However that happens, I'm still looking more into that, because I'd like to learn more about how that came about and what it's for. But
money makes the world go around.
Oh yeah. 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 Anytime I get confused about why, I just go, oh, it's probably money.
Well, it's very simple. As Nathan Rothschild said, he said, I care not who sits on the throne of the empire where the sun never sets, for I control the value of tender, and therefore I control the crown. So if you understand the narrative in that, the empire where the sun never set was obviously the British Empire, because their territories were so expansive that they, you know, had land where all around the world. And basically he was saying that I control the narrative, then I control the crown. And that's still the same way it is today. And a lot of people misconstrue and they think that they know better. But at the end of the day, if you look at it, what's just happened with COVID, what's happened with so many other circumstances in wars, and history is always told from the conquering race's perspective. And if you control the narrative, like if you're Dr. Fauci or you're the head of the CDC or whoever it is, you're going to have the same outcome, you know? You got to toe the line or you get kicked off the merry-go-round.
Got to go along to get along. And if you don't, you're out of the club. And didn't Jacob Rothschild just die?
He did, Mr. Burns.
Yeah,
he just... 97, I think it was.
Yeah, and they had a riderless black horse going around the, I think it was around the Westminster Abbey or wherever they do it. It's like a really formal monarchical thing that's only reserved for like royalty, and they did it for him and didn't really get much press coverage. I found that interesting.
There's a part of England which is called the City of London, which is like a autonomous country within the United Kingdom, in a similar way that the Vatican is in.
Same with DC.
The city limits of Rome. It's an autonomous piece of land. And when the crown, when the Queen used to go to meetings at the City of London, it's where that big condom-shaped building, I've been there quite a few times. I'm not really the biggest fan of England that much. I've been there many times. It's all right. Just rains all the time and the food fucking sucks. Hot women though, do like it for that. Good drugs, if you're about that kind of life. But yeah, there's a part of London that's actually an autonomous city. And so when the Queen visits, there's certain garb that she will wear with certain international representations of symbolism that, you know, in her different in the family crest that she wears specifically for those meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a city lot of people. What are you going to say? Sorry.
I was going to say the City of London is like the financial, they control the financials of England, right? And it's kind of like DC.
I think basically that's probably where they set the policy of financial rhetoric for the whole world, really, if you really wanted to get into the nuts and bolts of it. But at the end of the day, again, this is all opinions. People can argue back and forth. But in my opinion, as uneducated as it is, if you control the narrative, you control everything. And it's the same with cannabis for the last 70 years. If you control the narrative, you control everything.
Mm-hmm. And Reefer Madness was produced by Harry Anslinger, who was the first Treasury Secretary of Narcotics for our IRS. And he was actually a lobbyist slash stakeholder in DuPont. So
I know that I've met the DuPont family. I used to, they all live in Sun Valley where I used to live when I was very little. And one of their granddaughters is a professional skier. I won't mention her name, which is kind of funny. I've given a shit about the grandfather. Yeah. Anyways, I don't want to mention names.
That's funny. Yeah.
She's a cool chick and she's smoking hot. So I won't be a dick, but
shout out to her.
It is interesting how the world works. And a lot of people think that, you know, there isn't bias in these institutions, but really, like, how fucking naive do you need to be to think like that?
Mm-hmm.
Most people live in the land of make-believe, and again, that's just my opinion,
mm-hmm.
but it is what it is.
Yeah, these are just our two, you know, small, uneducated opinions, you know, that just...
It's pretty fucking obvious, though. It's like, if you actually go through the nuts and bolts, it's not that complicated.
Yep.
People just overcomplicate everything, and because, you know, obviously the numbers of people are growing in the world, people think that it's that much more technical, but really... The lobbyists of, you know, that, have you ever seen that movie, Thank You for Not Smoking? Is it Thank
mm-hmm.
You?
Mm-hmm.
Eckhart, the one that got him about the cigarette lobby.
Yep.
Great analogy on how America works.
Yep.
Same with a book, probably one of the great American novels that no one ever credits, which is Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley, which is basically the Illuminati fucking guidebook that they make all the kids read at the Charles Schwab School of Excellence. That talks about the Hegelian dialectic and about how, you know, you create, you know, factionalization in the cultures in order to be able to get your agenda to move forward. All these things are, you know, it's written into the dogma of how these kids get put in places of notoriety and how they base their opinions and their beliefs and, you know, how they keep us in check as sheep. Really, it's not that complicated.
No.
And if I was in power and I thought the same way, that would be the logical way to manage people. It's not. It's just human resources on a gigantic level.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah, it's just a scaled up version of like what you do at home. Really, you know,
just extra zeros, man. It's the same equation. It's just extra zeros.
Yep, and if I got 10 minutes left on this recording, if it stops recording, I'll just hit it record again and we'll just keep
going. No worries. Easy, man.
And that's what I saw when I moved back to Hollywood or LA area after being away from LA for a while. I came back and I was like, wow, Hollywood is just you can't get in unless you do what they say. That's my opinion based on what I saw.
It's not your opinion, it's fucking true. And it's like, it's a funny, like, I've lived in LA on and off. I got a bunch of friends that are famous movie stars and rock stars, and I've made music videos for some of the biggest rappers in the world, and I have friends that are some of the biggest indie producers and producers in Hollywood. It's all the same shit. It's like high school on crack, man. It's not
mm-hmm.
it's not that difficult. It's people think that he called you know, like that TV show Suits.
Mm-hmm.
My brother's a lawyer, right? My youngest brother Harley. He called it Days of Our Lives in Ivory Towers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's a good analogy on
that's
how the different things work. You know,
that's a great analogy.
Hollywood's funny because I have a few friends that are big producers and they're such weird people because they kind of like look at themselves like they're kind of like, because they're on. I think also it's a survival mechanism, because it's the same with big celebrities and people of notoriety, is because, and especially in America, in Australia it's not as bad, but in America everybody wants to get something from each other. It's capitalism mm-hmm. on crack. So when you it's like a hot girl, you know, like if a girl's a 9 or a 10 over a 10-year period, say she goes out once and three times a week, she's going to get hit on by 10 guys. You know, calculate that over a 10-year period, she's been hit on by 10, 15,000 men, you know? She's going to build up certain behavioral patterns in order to be able to weed out the non-eligible suitors. Does that mm-hmm. make sense?
Yep.
So it's the same psychology for somebody of notoriety or fame, that they're going to have, you know, fences or walls around themselves to be able to keep themselves in check so that people aren't trying to fuck with whatever they've got going on.
Yeah.
And so Hollywood's built up of all these, like, you know, a lot of it's based off, you know, false ideologies in the brain and yada, yada, yada. But I can understand the psychology of it. It's not, it really isn't rocket science.
No.
Again, in my opinion.
No, you're right. It's like high school. Best analogy, you know, cool kids over here, goth over here, you know, you got your groups and they all kind of intermingle. And
I couldn't imagine what high school in America was like, but I went to school in France and I went to school in Australia and I went to a bunch of different high schools and not good ones and blah, 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 blah. I actually went to 6 high schools. Not because I ever got kicked out or wagged or jig school or anything like that. Because when I was a kid, my dad told me, he said, if I, you guys call it play hooky, I think. Mm-hmm. We call it wag school. My dad said he wagged school once and his old man beat the fuck out of him. And he said, if you ever do it, I'm going to beat the fuck out of you. And my dad's like 6'1", looks like Hulk Hogan. He's pretty gnarly looking, bikey looking dude. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to wag school. And so my parents controlled me by, not that I was really a bad kid, but they controlled me. They said, you know, if you misbehave, then you can't go skiing. And had, because I lived so far away from the mountains, I lived in a surf town. I had to spend a lot of my life traveling to these places in order to be able to do the sport that I was addicted to. So that's how my parents kept me in check.
Yep. Well, some incentives, you know, some incentivize you. You know, that's the only way anybody's ever going to get, you know, and that's the thing, you know, that ties back into cannabis perfectly. You know, if you go to these lobbyists or whoever, and you have to incentivize them to legalize cannabis, and the cannabis lobby is not that big as of now, it's growing. But the first super PAC, unfortunately, was formed here in America for cannabis, and it has Philip Morris on the board. So a lot of good news probably coming for them. But they're already, you know, they're already into the cannabis game a long time. You know, they've been in it for a while. So
my dad met an executive board member of Philip Morris Australia about 25 years ago at the Gold Coast Indy, which is like, remember kart racing?
Mm-hmm.
And we were staying at a really notorious hotel. Mario Andretti we saw him at breakfast and yada, yada, yada. And anyways, my dad made friends with this guy that worked for Carlton United, which was a big brewing company. And then he went to he got invited to the corporate box and he ended up meeting this dude from Philip Morris. And he discussed with my dad, this is a long, long time, this was when I was a little kid, that they had precautionary measures in place already, plans of action for when cannabis was going to be legalized.
Yeah.
So, and I've heard this from other people, but this was from the horse's mouth. You know what I mean?
Yep.
My dad's a very much counter to me. He's very much a non-bullshit kind of guy. He's very straight to the point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they've had, you know, why wouldn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's interesting you say that, because when I kind of had my, you know, aha moments reading all, I'm a dork. I like poli sci. So I read all these bills that they pass, you know, mm-hmm. When they passed the hemp farm bill, just coincidence that the amount of money they passed was the amount of hemp we imported, in a certain avenue for the green area. And what's interesting is they planted hemp at Chernobyl. So they know what it does, which the vegetation's coming back quicker. And I read something similar like that. And the theory in my hypothesis is, okay, if you're going to use these oils and plastics and stuff, why stop before you need to? But like you said, if you're running the world like a business resource or whatever, and you're going to use up, it's like
the Saudis have got much, much more oil than they let on. It's the same with De Beers and controlling the diamond supply. Most of it's underneath. If you watch Blood Diamond or talk to somebody that understands the diamond game,
mm-hmm.
If you go to Antwerp, there's massive, massive, massive fucking safes underground, you know, probably labyrinths of diamonds that are underneath the city. And that's how they control the supply and demand. And it's mm-hmm. the same with the petrodollar. It's the same with, it's all economics. And that's why Noam Chomsky, who you probably know who he is, mm-hmm. one of the, you know, the highest, one of the, you know, great philosophers of the 20th century, he said that, I'm pretty sure he said it, or maybe someone else said it. He said that the power of the pen is greater than that of the sword. And basically, economists, they pretty much can, you know, wipe out a whole country with one swipe of their pen.
Mm-hmm. I love Noam Chomsky until he went woke. Yeah, until he said the unvaccinated should be put on an island and basically, you know, extradited from society, but you know,
well, maybe he's a psyop, who knows, you know, like that's why the Matrix is interesting, because it's like a matrix within a matrix. And if you got to, in my opinion, again, if I was the one that was controlling the world and I wanted to control everybody, I would create systems in order to be able to control people within controlling people.
Yep.
It's not rocket science.
Yep.
People just think that, why would they do that? They wouldn't do that. Like, but necessity is the mother of all innovation, you know, or invention. So yeah. if you have the necessity to be able to need to do this to control a populace, then you're going to do that. And they have a 200-year plan. That's why they have a system in place, if they do exist, where there is a central cabal and a central, you know, like hierarchy of people that hold each other in check, because, you know, power. What's the quote that all power corrupts. Exactly, all power corrupts. So if you're going to set up a system and you want it to last and have a legacy for your the next generation and going forward, you're going to set up a system with checks and balances in place in order to be able to control human error. Because if there's one person in charge, like the king or the queen or, you know, the sultan or the pope, there's usually going to be some kind of human error involved. So you're going to create a board of directors, and you're going to create, have plans in place. Contingency plans, excuse me. It's only very early in the morning. It's only 6 o'clock.
We'll let it slide. You're good. You're drinking your coffee. So you're solid. Got another coffee. Good to go.
Yeah, black coffee. Gotta nice. Do the fucking intermittent fasting.
Are you doing that?
Yeah, I always do it. Well, I try to.
Yeah, same. Now, do you do much with hemp at all? Like, I know you said you do CBD and stuff, but
I have some interest in an Australian hemp company that my dad and I have invested in. There is some kind of, how do I say, some ideas that have been passed around. Ironically, the new CEO of my cannabis empire, which is moving forward at the moment, we're actually doing our first money raise next week for 1.5 Australian. Our new CEO, he actually runs what still is one of the most progressive 3D printing companies in the Southern Hemisphere, called Titomic. Shout outs to Jeff. I originally got in contact with him because he used to run one of the biggest ski and snowboard manufacturing companies in the world. And that's how he got into 3D printing. And it's a long story. But basically, I got in contact with him because I wanted to build 3D printed hemp on-site offices and eco-villages that all connected together for mining companies in extreme weather conditions. And that were all carbon neutral and had, you know, big solar powered, you know, blah, 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 that all connected together like Lego. And that's something that I will potentially get into once I've got a pot to piss in, as they say in Australia. So I'm very close to doing that. I haven't traveled for almost 4 years since 2020. I flew back from Dubai. I was staying with my billionaire's house in the Palm. I went there for 3 weeks. I was meant to come back to Australia and then go to the States for 2 months. This is about 6 months after we launched Tioga Green, which is our cannabis dispensary that opened in October of 2019. I had plans to go to the States and obviously start expanding different companies and yada, yada, yada. Then COVID hit. And then that was kind of the beginning of the downfall of what was my amazing life. So I still have an epic life, don't get me wrong. But I got obviously 2.5 years, we couldn't travel. And then after the Opera House stunt, where we projected cannabis leaves and different kinds of cannabis art on the iconic Sydney Opera House with lasers, I was on bail for 22 months. And wasn't allowed to travel until I won my court case probably about 7 weeks ago.
I was going to say, it's all February-ish, right?
Yeah, and yeah, beginning of February, I think. So about 8 weeks ago. So we actually,
Congrats.
they the judge is the judge awarded us half of our costs back, and now I'm suing the New South Wales Police in the civil court for hopefully what will be a quite substantial amount of money, because when I was arrested, I was put on bail. My bail conditions were pretty extreme. I wasn't allowed within 3 kilometers of the Sydney Central Business District. I had to report into the police station 3 times a week, and under the bikie laws, which we have in Australia, the non-conforming laws for organized crime, I was, because we were considered, I guess, a terrorist or a national
Right.
threat, they said to us that I wasn't allowed to communicate with Alec, with Craze, who's my partner in crime in all these stunts, and who are we hurting over the last 8 or 9 years. We weren't allowed to talk to each other for almost a year. So they really tried to throw the book at us, and it really kind of, it didn't fuck up my life, but it definitely was a big pain in my ass. And obviously, when you do these kind of activist stuff, we were pretty lucky for a long time that we never did get arrested, but we never really did anything that was arrestable. It was more like, little petty things like putting 100 weed plants all through Sydney. You're going to probably get done for littering, which is, like a $500 to $1,000 fine. Really, who gives a fuck? You know what I mean? But indirectly through getting arrested, we got a lot more press, and obviously we've become probably we've got notoriety worldwide now, as before it was a bit more Australian based. So at the end of the day, what we do is to create, we want to create mischief and a little bit of mayhem to get people talking, in order to be able to expose the fact that, cannabis needs to be legalized and needs to be available for the masses. And if I have to take a couple of hits on the head for that, for the greater cause, then that's why I started doing what I started doing. And that's part of the game. It is what it is. And if you don't pay to play, then you don't play. And as it has been very disadvantageous to my amazing life that I had before, where I got to travel a lot. But again, like, if you don't put on for your city, then nothing changes.
And it just goes to show that, that in my opinion, from just now hearing a little bit more about your background, your connections, it seems like now that, like, okay, if you didn't think he was really, passionate about the plant and serious, that, because you travel a bunch, you could have very easily said, well, we can't do this because I may not travel, and kept your cush
Yeah,
stuff. But
I'm not a pussy. Fuck that. You got to put on, man. Like, if you want to cause change, you got to be willing to put your head on the chopping block. And who knows what'll happen next? I don't know. Maybe I'll end up going, I'm not going to put that out into the universe, but I'm committed to this cause and committed to another couple of causes out there. I'm now working on some other stuff for a notable Australian that's locked up in jail. I won't mention his name, but you probably know who I'm talking about. I'm working on something pretty massive, some publicity stuff, and we want to expand out into different causes, because there's a lot of unheard things in the world, and we have a skill set where we know how to shake shit up and make a noise get heard out into the universe. And that's the only, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything, pretty much. It's the one of the the testaments of the life that I am trying to live.
I was when I first got introduced to the world of politics when I was younger, ironically, I was like, it was in the 90s, 92, Clinton came to, he was rallying for his whatever. And again, this was back then. I'm not a Clinton guy or whatever, but I just wanted to say that, like, I saw how much he commanded a crowd. And everybody was watching him, and I was like, okay, you got to have allies in high places to get things done, but you also got to do what you do. You got to put your neck on the line for the cause. And just to let you know, got a friend in Austin if you ever need anything, so just, give me a shout.
I'll come visit you in a couple of months. No problem. We can do a podcast in real life. I haven't been to Austin yet. My parents went there, not, weren't they last year or the year, maybe a year and a half ago. They loved it. Just after COVID dropped, they went there. They went to New Orleans. They went to a bunch of places. We've always grown up going to California. I've driven from California to Canada and back 4 or 5 times with my family. We used to live in a place called Fernie, in the middle of shit kick of British Columbia, the middle of nowhere. But great skiing there. And so I've done the West Coast to death. I've been to the East Coast a few times, but there's no mountains there, so it never really interested me that much. But I'd like to go to Austin because there's a lot of hot girls and some good music too.
A lot of great music. I was at Antone's nightclub, you know, a few weeks ago, and we'll go to the Mothership. We'll go to the Comedy Mothership, see some good comedy. It's Joe Rogan's new place, but there's like 20 comedy clubs here.
I want to go see the what's that? What's the comedy show that where they you got to like line up and then normal comedians come on?
Kill Tony.
Yeah, Kill Tony. Yeah.
Yeah, they do it live.
A couple of months ago. Yeah, no, I know that. That looks really cool.
Anytime.
I'd love to be one of the people on there, like one of the hosts. Like that'd be rad. That'd be a cool experience.
Yeah,
and it's also really on my list to do. You know, once we get a bit more established, to try and do Rogan too. He'd be an interesting cat to talk to.
Yes, and he, I mean, his club is awesome. It's perfectly curated for a comedy experience. It's very friendly. It's awesome. I you know, we'll definitely go when you get down to here to ATX for sure.
So, yeah. So I think that the world, you know, you need people to stand up for causes and, you know, obviously we love attention, you know, it comes with, a lot of, you know, positive things, but it also comes with a lot of negative things. You know, as I said before, at the beginning of this interview, the Japanese proverb says the nail that sticks out gets hammered in. But my rebuttal, again, was be made of diamond and break the hammer. And diamonds are formed under pressure. So if I am a lot of things. I can be arrogant. I have a big ego. There's a lot of things that people could probably tar me with. But there's one thing that I'll never be, and that's a fucking hypocrite. So if I want to put on, I want to talk shit about some subject, I'll put on. And no one can say that I didn't, because I've been to jail multiple times for this shit. And but again, I'm just one cog in a giant wheel, you know. There's people back in the day when normal, they were getting life sentences for growing pot. You know, I'm not claiming that we're doing anything that is necessarily changing the world, but we're doing a lot with what little we have.
And you just touched on a huge issue in the cannabis discussion here, which is equity. You know, in the cannabis war on drugs, you know, all the people that were harmed, you know, in jail for lifetime, 25, 50 years, just for possession. You know, some are selling mass with, you know, whatever, but nonviolent.
But a lot of those equity programs are wrapped in they're not run as a lot of the programs in the United States, like the one that they tried to do in Washington State, that's just now gone back to not having all drugs decriminalized. So a lot of the systems that you guys try to have in play, like that social equity system like they have in Oakland, in order to be able to give people that have been affected by cannabis cannabis control licenses to open dispensaries, great idea in ideology.
In theory,
but
yeah.
In fact, from what I've heard, and again, this is just what I've heard that a lot of people have been, you know, corporations have been paying these people that have been affected by it in order to be able to make money off them. Now, at the same time, at the end of the day, from an economic standpoint, that person's still making money and getting, you know, getting paid. So again, I guess they are getting their credence back. Mm-hmm. So again, it is what it is. But I think America's built off a lot of, you know, great ideas, but they're not really good, kind of
execution.
But again, it's difficult because you guys have a population of 350 to 400 million people. Yeah. You know, if you counted all the illegals and the 8 million new illegals that have just come across the border to et cetera, it's a difficult thing. There's a lot of factionalization in American politics. There's a lot of lobbying. And at the end of the day, I think one of the biggest problems with America is that you guys are so anti-socialist, which I can understand why, but you know, you guys don't have the basics that we have, which is free healthcare and, you know, social welfare. If you don't have a job and you like lose everything, like if you in America, if you lose your job and you have no money, you're pretty much fucked unless you got rich parents. So imagine if you're a felon, you come out of jail, you can't find a job, no one's going to give you a chance. You know, you end up either doing crime or you become homeless. Now there is other options. I do understand that it can be done. Many other people have done it. But the system in a way is to kind of, you know, Americans celebrate getting up off each other. It's like capitalism on crack.
It's weird.
which is unfortunate.
I it goes back to what you're talking about, like collaboration. I've been hearing this a lot lately, how people are trying to go more towards collaboration as opposed to competition because, you know, we're because of the state of the society, you know, and like you're talking about license sharing, that's what they'll do. Kind of, it's like politicians in a way, like, hey, I found a minority person that we can just buy their license from them or say they're on our board. And then we'll say we're equity because we have them on our board, but really they're not even part of the company. We're just going to pay them on the side. Companies do that, but like you said, it's a good
there's nothing wrong with that. And if you look at through history, when were the times when the mafia was making the most amount of money? It was when they were collaborating with the five families, with the board that the Lucky Luciani set up, the commission.
Everybody
they were,
eats.
They were collaborating because they knew that death and destruction was too much, was very attention, it would seek attention, which is bad for business. So if you want good business, you collaborate. Mm-hmm. And if you look in, you know, I like a lot of these gangster movies because they've got a lot of, life lessons in them. And in the third Godfather, when Michael Corleone goes to the, and he meets the, I don't know if it's the, it's the,
not he's the like prime the cardinal,
minister, it might be the deputy prime minister or something. Oh. And the guy from the Vatican or the other gentleman says to him, now I'm going to introduce you to the real mafia. And, you know, obviously that's the politician. And so that is the way that the Boys Club works. And it's not going to change. And people say they're putting up their pickets and say, it's not fair. And it is what it is. And it isn't fair. And I am a man of the people, for the people. I understand in ideology that that's a great thing. But at the end of the day, and if you look through the history of the world, you cut off the snake, two more snakes appear. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage that? I don't know. But when people talk about being anti-capitalist, well, if you really want to be smart, write me a system that supersedes capitalism, like Lenin tried to do with, like Lenin did with what he thought was the best version of Marxism, mm-hmm. and created communism. Now, I don't agree with communism, but at least he had a really good argument.
Yeah. All these isms, ism is just, you know, idea. Ism means idea, and humans are flawed. So any idea that you try to implement as far as like controlling people, at some point, like we said, is inevitably going to be corrupted, you know, at some point, because humans are fallible. So that being said, you just try to decentralize as much power as you can, you know, and.
But there should be basics in a society, especially one that's taxing people so much. You know, you guys should have at least universal healthcare. So if you break your fucking leg or you need it, you have a heart attack, you should be able to go to the fucking doctor or to the hospital and get treated. It's a Western country. It's meant to be prosperous. You're meant to look after your people. But that's not how the United States works. And I understand that it's a little bit more difficult because there is 380 million people, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you spent the GDP of or the amount of money, or even a quarter of the money that they spend on defense, on healthcare, you guys would alleviate the problem. Now, the America doesn't need to spend that much on defense in order to be able to defend itself. Yes, it does need to spend a huge amount of money to remain the one superpower of the world. But as Eisenhower said in his closing speech when he went out as president, this is a two-term five-star war hero general. There was a two-term Republican president in the 60s. I think it was 52, was it? Maybe. Anyways, might have been 52. Might have been a little later, 57 or something like that, because it was before JFK.
Yeah.
He said that the biggest threat to the American population is the industrial military complex. And basically people racketeering the American government and just making money off them.
Yep.
And that's tyrannistic. Yep. So in my opinion, you guys need and this is probably never going to happen. It's a figmented illusion of my imagination. You should at least have the basics that if you get fucked up, you can go to the hospital and get looked after. You know, my father, he had a car accident in the United States in 1996, end of 96. He was on life support for 3 days. The only reason he's alive is because he had a platinum platinum Amex card in his back pocket. The bill for 2 weeks in hospital was $600,000 Australian dollars.
Jeez. That's
now, my parents had money. They worked really fucking hard to make all their cash. But to have 600 grand, and my mum flew over from Australia, and before they even let her see my dad, they took her into a room and made her sign a document to say that she could pay this bill. So, like, I mean, that's only my limited experience, but that's a pretty good experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's directly seeing my dad almost die, only be alive probably because he's got a lot of money, or he had a representation of what could have been a lot of money. And basically, like, to them, he's just a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And human life shouldn't be a commodity, and neither should the, the fact that they can charge such exorbitant rates for basic pharmaceutical stuff for people that have ailments like cancer and all these different diseases, and then they can profiteer on such a major, major level. It's blasphemy.
It's treason, it's in my opinion. Don't you know we can't have healthcare? Don't you know we have bombs to make? We have bombs to make. You know,
totally, like, but that should be the basics of a Western. If you're going to be a pillar of the Western symbology to take to the rest of the world, wouldn't you want to have basic healthcare for your people?
You would think. You would think. And it's interesting because we don't have universal healthcare or legal cannabis, but we're printing a bunch of money and sending it to Ukraine, and they just legalized cannabis.
Well, they legalized. But you know that. If you want to get into the debate of about the Ukrainian war, you know, we're baiting Russia into a World War III. And again, the only reason that they want that is because they want to make money. The industrial military complex wants to sell more bombs, more drones, you know, more super kits for all these troops, and just make money. And that's the problem. And I think that, you know, cannabis is one thing. And as an activist of cannabis, really in the big scheme of things in the world, cannabis isn't the biggest deal. You know what I mean? Like, we put it on a big pedestal because we're potheads. It's such a big deal to our lives, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, like, universal healthcare, that's a much bigger problem. And in Australia, we're pretty lucky. Like, you know, like, just to give you an example, I blew my knee out twice. The first time I got the best surgeon in Australia, cost me 15 grand. That was when I still had ski sponsors. And I borrowed, you know, I got 10 off them. And then I think I had five, or I borrowed five off my dad. And then obviously health, and I paid for it. And then healthcare paid for some of it, et cetera. I think altogether with all my rehab, it was about 20 grand, 25 grand, you know, over a 6 month period, which is quite a bit of money. Fast forward maybe 3 years later, I did it again. I didn't have the same sponsors anymore. I was getting a bit older. And my parents were like, well, just go into the hospital and just go through the normal healthcare. Anyways, I went to the Northern Beaches Hospital in Sydney. The previous time I'd been dealt with by Dr. Rowe, who did all the Red Bull athletes. He does all the Olympic athletes. He was the best knee surgeon, maybe in the Southern Hemisphere. And at that time I was competing at a high level and I really wanted to get back to what I was doing. So I paid the money. Now I went back 3 years later, 4 years later, and then I went through the public system. I went and got my consultation with the doctors in the hospital. Anyways, they put me, there's three different tiers about how quick you got to do it. He put me on the second tier because he's like, oh, you're an athlete. You know, he liked me. I just kind of smoothed him a little bit. Anyways, fast forward 3 months later, I got pretty much almost the same, not quite the same level surgeon, but pretty close. He was like, he'd done, you know, a lot of knee surgeries for a lot of athletes. Anyways, fast forward 3 months later, whole process done, hospital care cost me $600.
It's the American, and there's millions of other cases just like that, you know, and I'm with you. Even though cannabis is, like you said, important to us, it pales in comparison to healthcare, to, you know, a right to exist.
It's not a problem until it faces you, until you got some loved one that can't get a, you know, a heart bypass or whatever the fuck it is. You know, they say money is the root of all evil, but it's lack of money is the root of all evil, because you have to do certain things in order to be able to get money to get shit done, to be able to fix yourself or your problem.
Yeah. Money is freedom. money is freedom to do more things. The healthcare issue here, the VA, the Veterans Administration, is literally not even legally allowed to say the word cannabis or marijuana in you know, when they're prescribing pills or anything like that, because the pharmaceutical hold is so around the neck of our government.
They control the narrative. And so, you know, I think that I'm all for activism. I'm all for shaking things up. But I think that to really fix the problems we have in society, and cannabis, you know, is one that's obviously very prominent to our hearts. We need to fix the narrative. We need to go look a little bit more of like through the magnifying glass and figure out why is this the way that it is, and then, you know, consider it correctly, and then come up with policy change in order to be able to have a system that will work for the next, you know, 300 to 500 years.
Yep. And sustainable. That's not going to have bank runs or failures or...
It'll be economically sustainable. And it's not that difficult. There are other things in the world that have been dealt with in the correct way. But I think that, like you said, fixing UN mandates, fixing federal banking laws, fixing all of these things that, you know, they're roadblocks and people... But I guess in the same way, people are just trying to get some kind of change, you know?
Yeah.
Which is good. That has happened in Australia. We do have medical cannabis now. It is a really positive thing for a lot of people. But then at the same time, you know, we've got our harsh drug driving laws. At the moment, I have no license because in Australia, they do a drug swab. I hadn't smoked in two days, 48 hours. They do a swab, came up cannabis. I wasn't impaired at the time, just the presence of cannabis. And they take your license away for 3 months immediately, even if you're a medicinal cannabis user. So the last year stunt that we did, we took a military convoy with Lad Bible, and we had like a squirrel, which is like a tank with wheels. We had a big stretch limo. We had a Hummer. We had a bunch of military vehicles. And we drove around Sydney with a peace declaration to end the war on drugs and to help medicinal cannabis patients be able to drive. Now, in my opinion, if you don't have a test to be able to test the impairment of the driver at the time, then it shouldn't stand up in a court of law. But this is one of the biggest problems that's holding back adult use recreational cannabis in Australia, is these really harsh drug driving laws. So that's something that we've been campaigning with, you know, different, the Legalized Cannabis Party and the Greens Party here in Australia. The Legalized Cannabis Party now have, I think, 7 or 8 members in different states at a state level in order to be able to change things in our parliaments. In Tasmania, they do have a like something in place. So if you do go to court, you can get let off for being a medicinal cannabis patient. Mm-hmm. We are working in Victoria, New South Wales, and hopefully Queensland in order to be able to change this. But like, silly laws like this are what holds back a lot of people becoming medical cannabis users. Because if you're, say, a single mother, like not having a license, I live 10 minutes in the middle of the fucking sticks. It's ruined my life. Now, I'm a capable male. I don't have kids. And it's had this much impact on me. I've you know, lost a lot of my money. It's my sex life sucks. And I understand that these are just problems that face me. But if I had real problems, like I had 3 kids and I was a single mother and I needed to drive, you know, 20 miles in order to be able to go to work in the city or wherever the fuck it is, but I wanted to use medical cannabis, I would be like, oh, I can't, even though I'm on these opiates that are fucking me up and hurting my stomach or giving me this, you know, crazy anxiety or whatever the after effects are of these opiates or other alternative medicines that the pharmacists are throwing down these people's gullets, you know, medical cannabis could probably be really helpful for that person in question. But a lot of them are scared because they can't lose their license because it's their livelihood. And if they lose their livelihood, they can't provide for their family and for their kids. And that is a really big problem that I, myself and Alec and all of the Who Are We Hurting Collective and different people around Australia and probably around the world have been really trying to push for hard, is to change the drug driving laws, because they are really difficult. They're really unfair and they're really detrimental to people who are trying to get, you know, to get cured of their ailments through medicinal cannabis.
Yeah, they just passed federal. It was a federal research by our federal government, and I don't know how about Australia, but they just revealed two new testing methods for on-site testing, like exactly what you're just saying.
You'll have to send me that link.
I will. I will. And by them saying that,
I'm sorry, what were you going to say? Pardon me.
I was going to say by them saying that, they're in essentially admitting they currently don't have any accurate testing methods. So here in America, when they bust you, they just take it all. They don't charge you. They just take it all. And
but they do roadside swab testing in certain parts of America, do they?
Yeah. But like
it's
you
rare
said,
though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like you said, okay, you have cannabis in your system, but like, okay, it could have been yesterday, last night, you know, it's kind of the same thing.
So you don't lose your license.
No, I think you got to go to court and stuff like that. And like, these are all things being worked out. And the interesting thing about that is that
at least they're talking about working it out. Here in Australia, they're just like, nah, fuck you. No license, 3 months immediately, from the presence of it. And so, and a lot of my friends have told me, like, cause I'm trying to advocate for a system that like tests for things. And a lot of them think that that's silly, that they, you know, they just need to have a bylaw there to be able to just let cannabis patients do what they need to do, you know? But I don't think a lot of people just want to put a band-aid on a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm more of the, you know, the logical person. I'd like to see the problem fixed.
Yeah.
At the base layer, because it's going to keep coming up in the future. Even though it might seem that we've jumped 10 steps forward right now, in 10 years, it'll come back and bite us in the ass.
Yeah. And usually whatever solution they're agreeing on isn't exactly the best solution anyway. You know, they're just appeasing people. And then it's like a band-aid later down the road, like the bank stuff. You know, it's like, hey, we bailed you out, but that doesn't mean you change the system. And about 10 years, you're going to have to bail us out again because we're just running too much debt. But
you know, you live in Texas and you live in the city of Austin, as if you just said, and off camera, you said that the city of Austin has decriminalized cannabis in the county limits. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as you go out of that county, you could be really, really fucked if you get caught with cannabis. Is that correct?
Yep.
Texas, don't mess with Texas.
Don't mess with Texas. The Texas PD or the, I forget what it's called, the Texas State Police, they actually troll for people like leaving out of Austin because they know it's decriminalized and stuff like that. You know, a girl I work with, worked with at the smoke shop, you know, she's like, yeah, I'm on probation because I had stuff in my car, you know, and in Texas, you can still be thrown in jail 6 months. Like they throw the book at you because, you know, the DEA people are still that I can when I say DEA, I consider the police state, the entire thing. They're still trying to get their cut. And if anything, right now, they're trying to squeeze out these last little bits of cannabis law until they know it's going to flip the switch soon. I think that they're just waiting for the infrastructure to be built out. I mean, personally,
there's so many more bigger problems in America. Your murder rate is like 10,000-11,000 people get murdered in your country every year. There's immigrants coming over the border illegally. There's homeless people everywhere. You know, you think that there would be there's a much bigger problem than cannabis. And if you look at the states where they have decriminalized and legalized adult use, you know, the other drug rates don't go up. The road toll deaths don't go up. And
crime
then
goes down.
They make all of this money off the daily excise or the weekly excise or the monthly excise or the yearly tax excise that then gets put back into the coffers of the community to be able to better the nation and the state and the community at large by putting that tax money into roads, hospitals, schools, drug rehabilitation programs for people on harder drugs. Like it's all.
Stop talking like that. That seems too logical. That seems way too logical to do. Well, you know, you could grow a plant that you could sell like hemp for carbon credits in a greenhouse that produces food, which is a superfood. And then it produces cannabis, which is a medicine. And then you tax that in your community and you fix the roads. And Colorado's got a surplus of tax revenue. They don't even know what to do with it. And California is a mess.
California is a really funny place, man. It's like It's a real like that Chili Peppers song Californication is just like it is you know, obviously you are a Californian at heart, but the California that I grew up going to, you know, a couple of times a year, my family live there, I've grown up going there on and off, I've always, you know, skate culture, surf culture, you know, I was obsessed with punk rock when I was a kid, hip-hop, all of these staple points of my life were all California. Even cannabis, it's all California. People can argue, but at the end of the day, in my opinion, the majority of pot culture comes from either California or, you know, British Columbia, which is basically West Coast culture. Let's call it West Coast culture. Okay. Yeah. Now, and, you know, the last time I went to California was 2019. My dad went 8 months ago. He said it's just a total shit show. I see videos get sent to me of Oakland, and it looks like favelas in Calcutta.
I'll tell you one better. So where I lived, you might know where this is. I lived on the corner of Fairfax and Wilshire, right there, the Museum Row and all that stuff. The corner where Biggie was shot. I lived right there. I worked at a dispensary that I lived above. Okay. So I didn't, you know, I was right there. And during COVID, it was like near the end of COVID, I was going to get a coffee, just a coffee and a blueberry muffin. And I walked by a homeless person, you know, laying on the ground, which that's normal in LA now. So you just kind of ignore it because you think on the way back, oh, they'll be gone in 5 or 10 minutes. They'll just wake up and then go continue on about their day. Nope. When I came back, just holding coffee and a blueberry muffin, that person was in a body bag. They were roped off. And there was like 4 or 5 police cars just standing there taking pictures and notes. And I'm sitting there going, I just walked over a dead body to go get a muffin and a coffee in front of my apartment. And I'm paying what for this?
Even Beverly Hills and stuff is falling apart. Like that new mansion tax they tried to put in like recently, yeah, that on all the luxury real estate. Great, great idea, but shitty execution, you know.
Yeah, everybody's like for sale. Everybody's
liberal ideologies are great in principle, but I don't know, like there is some, you know, there's some positive economics makes a really big difference to the community. So a lot of these, you know, lefties or liberals have these ideologies of changing things, which is great in philosophy, but you have to have the system in order to be able to make it sustainable. Can't just make radical change and then just not have some kind of counterbalance in place to be able to balance out the economic effects or the effects in the society. Just like them trying to legalize all drugs in Washington, you know, there's fucking crackheads everywhere. But was that because they legalized drugs, or was that because that the cops weren't arresting people anymore after George Floyd and all the other bullshit that happened? And basically downtown Seattle turned into a fucking war zone. And there was like areas that were like basically like little countries.
Same like Portland.
That's basically not enforcing the police. And, you know, like legalizing drugs and then not making people go to their meetings to be able to go to rehab if they get caught with it. You have to have a system in place to be able to balance out the ramifications of the changes that you're making in the society. And so that's why, in my opinion, I'm all for drug change. Like, the war on drugs has not worked.
No.
Drug legalization is a great idea.
Drugs won.
Well, I don't know if all drugs works. Maybe. I don't know. Portugal has worked. But then Portugal is a little bit socialist, and they don't have the same economic destability problems that the United States faces. That's they also point. Don't have... You're going to have to restart it again in a minute.
Yeah. I'll just do it.
You only get 40 minutes. You also don't have, you know, a population of fucking high-end users. America, Australia, where it's a bit of a different culture, you know. Like the Europeans, they don't indulge in drugs and alcohol in the same capacity that Americans, Australians do, in my opinion. The English, they do it too.
You guys don't grow up with it as destigmatized as we do. You know, like, we can't touch alcohol till we're 21. Yeah. So what would you recommend, you know, for anybody that's younger, you know, coming into the 18 to 25 crowd and they're trying to get involved in cannabis or let alone, you know, bigger issues? Where do you think they should start based on your experience?
I think that, so are you talking about just from a base level, like just learning the, like how to get into the game of entrepreneurialism and like cannabis as a job, or as in getting into cannabis as an activist?
Yeah, sure. So that's a good question. Let me rephrase that. So if they wanted to do entrepreneurship, like if they wanted to get cannabis industry, where would they start?
I reckon go hang out at your local, bud club. It depends where you are in the world. Like where you live it's a lot easier. In Australia, mm-hmm. it's difficult. It was a lot easier than it was 10 years ago. Before 10 years ago, it didn't exist. 10 years ago here, you'd have to know somebody that was a criminal, basically, mm-hmm. to be able to get into it. But also, if you get some seeds, you can learn how to grow. You know, it's not rocket science. People know how. I'm not a cultivator personally. I don't have a green thumb in any way, shape, or form. But I do have a lot of friends that do it. If I was in a place where there was a little bit of legality, whether it was medicinal cannabis or recreational cannabis, I would do it in the same way that I did it with skiing, or a lot of my skater friends have done. Go hang out at your local shop, and go, try and get an internship. Go tell them that you'll clean the floors, or you'll trim for them for free. Do whatever it takes to be able to get in with the click. Hang out with the click, just like how Burner did it. If you listen to some of his podcasts, he talks about how he got into the game at the early parts of the early days. You know, he was around the dispensaries. He just shut up and he just did. They said jump. He said how high. And slowly but surely, he showed a value. And then that value was seen as a talent. And somebody was like, I can make some money off that talent. And then they made him the head buyer for whatever dispensary it was that he worked for. And slowly but surely, he stacked his knowledge and his connections, and he has now built an empire. So basically, you just got to be around it. You got to immerse yourself in the culture. Doesn't matter whether it's skiing, surfing, filmmaking, or cannabis, whatever it is, you need to be around the people making shit happen, and you need to go and add a value. So be that annoying kid that hangs out and won't leave. And even if you are a bad smell, just, be like, I will do anything. I will clean the floor. And they might use you a little bit, but, be the fly on the wall. Listen, don't talk. Just listen. Listen, learn as much game as you can. And then, fast forward, a few years, and you'll have opportunities just, serendipitously appear in front of you. But you also have to be aware that when these opportunities come in front of you, you have to be able to open the door and then walk through the door. Mm-hmm. So basically, the best advice that I ever heard was from a gentleman named Andrew Montel, and it was at a big street culture talk, and he was one of the founding fathers of hip hop in Australia, and he created a magazine, and he now owns Complex Australia. But he said in the talk at the symposium, he said, the best advice I ever got was do whatever it takes. So basically, you have to be willing to go and be somebody's, I wouldn't say bitch, but you have to be willing to go and be low on the totem pole. And in today's culture, with Instagram and YouTube and stuff like that, everybody wants to be at the top of the totem pole immediately. That's not how the world works. It can work in certain circumstances like that, but usually that's not sustainable. You got to kind of go learn what's what, and then earn your stripes and slowly start ticking boxes. And over a period of time, opportunities will, just manifest themselves.
That's great advice. That's spot on also about kind of like my trajectory as well. Like, cause I started in the business world just as a weed smoker, sold it in college, but nothing like you, no growing, no like business true, just selling the normal eighth or whatever. But I went to LA, and instead of doing, I'm in film and acting and stuff like that. So instead of like doing bartending and serving, I was like, I'm just going to work in a dispensary. And that's way more chill than working at a bar. So I printed 20 resumes, and I literally Googled on my iPhone, the closest dispensaries. And I just walked in with resumes, and I was like, I want a job. I want a job. Are you hiring? I want a job. I want a job. And the last one, literally the last one, was like, yeah, you can start at the front desk tomorrow. I was like, sick. And I was there 2 or 3 years, worked all my way up. I had the keys. That's the place I lived above. That job got me a brand job. That got me a job at the lab. So it's exactly like you said, but there's always somebody that's been doing it longer. There's always someone that's been doing it longer.
But you know, you don't necessarily. There's different ways to skin a cat. You know, like I would never work for somebody else. But I would. But the way that I came through was different. You know, I got schooled in the game in a different era, and I guess was kind of put on a pedestal at a young age because I was a professional athlete. But at the same time, being around that, working, having big sponsors, and learning about marketing, and learning about you know, how supply and demand worked, and learning about deadlines and all that kind of shit. I learned that from being, you know, having, you know, involvement with my ski sponsors, but I had an interest in it. And then I'd go and work for them. And also my dad was an entrepreneur. So I'd go and work, you know, packing boxes and doing this. So it depends on the card that you dealt. Everybody else has dealt a different card. But if I was me, and I had nothing, and I had no connections and no experience and no previous connections to anything that I now have inroads with, that would be how I would want to be told by someone like myself if I was 18 and fresh off the boat and just, you know, like, you know, I was, you know, new to the game, so to speak.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then at the same time, you know, if you want to start a business, you know, like, Find a niche that everyone isn't attacking, and then put together some really good designs. Put together a deck, and then try and raise money. You know, like there's many ways. Like I said, the best advice I've ever heard someone give was do whatever it takes. At the same time, though, you don't want to go and you know, commit crimes and rip people off, as some notorious people in this industry have been said to do. As I won't mention names, but someone that probably one of the most prominent people in this industry, who I'd mentioned earlier, you know, I've heard on the grapevine that, you know, he used to be a crop raider. Now, I don't know this person personally. I don't really have an opinion on it because it's not I'm not on the level that he's on. So I don't have the opinion. And I'm Australian. I'm an outsider. I'm not from California. I'm not trying to be someone I'm not. Now, I know people that know what's what, you know, people that some of the third generation Humboldt kids, yada yada yada, that have run and, you know, pounds all through America, and these are people that I know, but that's not me personally. Now, they're allowed to have an opinion on the subject, but me personally, I'm an outsider trying to make, you know, make it in the game that I'm a guest in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it depends on the different circumstances for different people, but at the end of the day, you know, being humble, and sometimes you got to go earn your stripes, whatever it is. The same with us, you know, putting on and going and doing all these stunts, and, you know, spending, you know, thousands of hours and hundreds of thousands of our own dollars and stuff like that. Like, that's given me credibility in industry. So now when I go meet people, they take me seriously. As of before, I was just some skier kid, you know, and that's cool. Like, that was a position to work from. But, you know, the years and years of effort and energy that I've put in to a cause, it'd be, you know, it's difficult to question my commitment to the fact that I really do like cannabis and I care about legalization. You know what I mean? Like, we put in enough work now to have some credibility, and you have to build that credibility through results and through hard work and through, you know, the humbling of life.
Yeah.
And the problem with today's, just in general today, which is, I understand why it is what it is, because, you know, Instagram, everything is instant gratification. Fuck, it's taken me 5 years to get where I'm at now, and I don't have that much cash at the moment. I just spent, you know, 10 grand on this lawyer. I spent 5 grand on the lawyer for my drug driving case so I wouldn't get a criminal conviction, so I'd come back to America. You know, I've spent thousands of dollars on putting it into all these. You know, I work my ass off, and I'm only just now getting to the point where I can do a money raise to be able to get off the rat wheel. You know what I mean? And you got to be willing to put yourself on. You got to invest in yourself. And it depends on how you want to skin stuff. I don't want to work for people. I don't want to be someone's bitch. That's not my game in life. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I got schooled. My dad's an entrepreneur. My grandfather was an entrepreneur. That's the way that I grew up. You know what I mean? That's what I know. Right. I don't know what someone else knows. But if I was in the position of not knowing anyone, I would go and, you know what, I've had every fucking shit job in the you could ever imagine. I've washed dishes. I've done tree lopping. I've, you know, worked at Hungry Jack's, which is the equivalent of Burger King, all to save shitloads of money to be able to go halfway around the world to go skiing. And yes, when I got better, I was starting to make money. But at the same time, you know, 4 to 5 months a year, I'm in Australia. I'm not skiing. And to be able to travel around the world is fucking expensive. Even if you do have a travel budget and you're making money, you know, during those off periods, you know, I would work my ass off to save money to be able to go overseas because, you know, partying is expensive and living in rich ski towns is expensive and, you know, good-looking women fucking are very expensive.
Oh, same.
All these things cost money, you know, and at the end of the day, I'm still not that well off yet, but I'm investing in myself to be able to get where I want to go. Because that core ideology that Andrew Montel guy said was do whatever it takes. Right. And I'm the kind of guy, unfortunately, much to my detriment sometimes, is I'm full send. And I'm not going to stop until I get where I want to go. And then I'll probably find something else once I get there. And then I'll, you know, channel my energy into that. Yeah. And the more money and the more notoriety and the more attention and all this stuff that I get, the more ability I get to be able to have the freedom I want and create the cool shit that I want to do. Because at the end of the day, it's not necessarily about money for me. It's about the opportunity to be able to create things that I want to create.
Yeah, that's well said. It's climbing the corporate ladder and entrepreneurship are two totally different, you know, paths. You know, they kind of
doesn't necessarily, I don't have the right to say what's better and what's not.
No,
me
yeah.
Personally, I wouldn't want to work for somebody else. I'd rather be broke and homeless than be that person. But that's just me personally. If you want to run, I have other friends that they want to be an employee. They want to run a Fortune 500 company, or they want to do this, or they want to do that. And, you know, my youngest brother, he's a lawyer. He chose that path. He could have been a professional athlete. He could have been the fucking movie star. He looks like Chris Hemsworth. He's 6'3". He's got long hair. He can do what he wants. But he wanted to choose the more sensible route because he's seen me go through all this fucking trials and tribulations and bullshit. And at the end of the day, like, being the nail that sticks out is difficult. People are going to tell you you're full of shit. People are going to give you shit, especially we have tall poppy syndrome in Australia, which is like people that stick out, they want to throw shit on you. And people don't want you to stand out. People don't want you to achieve things that they necessarily can't achieve themselves. So they'll talk shit about you. And the more notoriety and fame you get, the more people are going to talk shit. So at the end of the day, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. There is no solution. You just got to put your head down and your ass up and just go get shit done. And then when you stop, you're pretty much dead. That's probably the best advice you could get.
You're damned if you do. You're damned if you don't. So just do, right? Just fucking do it. And
just keep doing until you're dead, because you're going to be dead a long, long fucking time.
Yeah. I let people go YOLO. And I'm like, yeah, but you only die once too, right? You know, in theory. So, although it feels like we've died a thousand deaths.
It goes quick, man. Having grown up in action sports, you know, I know 30 to 50 people that are dead in the last 10 years from avalanches, crevasses, motocross accidents, skydiving, base jumping. You fucking name it, man. Like, another dude that I know just got broken off like probably a month and a bit ago doing a triple flip on a dirt bike, and he missed the airbag because he was training for Nitro Circus, and he's gone, man. So, you know, like, you got one life to live. Like, go live it. If you want to see change in the world, don't be someone that just sits on the fence and talks about things. Go and dive the fuck in and, you know, deal with the consequences.
Yeah.
Try to not get on the wrong side of the law, because it's really not fun sitting in a jail cell. I've only ever sat in a jail cell. You know, I've only ever been locked up for a few times, one time in Utah for like 3 grams of weed, less than 3 grams, maybe 2.5 grams. That was a process.
Sounds like Utah.
Yeah, I fucking fucked my life up. I got for 2.5 grams. I got locked up for 7 hours. It was $7,000 bail, which my friend bailed me out. Then I had to come back to Australia to get the what are they called? What's the federal charge called there? A felony. To not get a felony charge for 2 grams of pot, I had to get drug tested for four for 4 months in Australia, get a drug and alcohol analysis, psychological evaluation, and do after the 4 months was up, and send them all back to Utah in order to be able to get them dropped to misdemeanors. And then I flew back to America after I got a new ski sponsor, after going through 6 months of all this bullshit and having all these shitty jobs to pay for the lawyers and blah, blah, blah.
Man,
which is a hard thing to do when you're getting paid to travel around the world to do something, and then you got to go back to Australia. You can't do what you want to do. You got to get all these shitty jobs to be able to make money to pay for lawyers so you can go back to what you were doing before. That's a hard pill to swallow. I know other people have got a lot harder than I do, but just for 2 grams of fucking cannabis. And then I flew back to America and I filled out the wrong visa form. And then they fucking deported me.
Oh, yeah.
After like 6 months of bullshit, I get to the States and they're like, sorry, sir, you've got the wrong visa. And then they locked me up in that room with the VCR from the 80s. And I got locked up for 10 hours. And then they escorted me back with two TSA officers back to the Virgin flight and flew me back to Australia. So that was a kick in the teeth. So I've had a few kicks in the teeth over the years. Even though I look like the silver spoon little rich kid, my parents made me have every shitty job in the world you could ever imagine. And I've had to overcome adversity, as every other person in the world that has a story is going to tell you. You have to just keep going. And it fucking sucks sometimes. You're lonely. You're in the fucking doldrums. You can't drive because of this, or you're locked up because of this, or this, or whatever. You know, look at fucking Nelson Mandela. He was locked up for 30 fucking years, and then he becomes the prime minister of South Africa. You know, like, people that have, you know, that go overachieve adversity and have a tenacity, they usually are the ones that create the most impact on planet Earth.
Yeah. That's the shooting star in the sky. That's funny you mentioned Nelson Mandela. I have the same birthday as him. So July 18th. So I painted the Berlin Wall right next to him. So I'm a big fan of Nelson Mandela and everything that he, but like, and you
that
said,
was a struggle. Apartheid was a lot more of a detrimental thing on humanity than the illegality of cannabis, though.
Oh yeah.
But at the same time, who the fuck am I to? Well, actually, no, I'm not going to say that. No, that they're totally different, totally much worse. Apartheid. But this is a version of apartheid in itself, you know. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, you just have to be willing to put your nuts on the chopping block, and you just got to keep going. And you know, I've put all my money and effort into achieving what I want to achieve. Now I'm about to do this money raise, just as an example. If I don't get the first round, then I'm going to have to do crowdfunding. But then I'm on the precipice now, whether it's make or break. But that's the same with everybody that's ever achieved anything in the world. Elon Musk put his own money in when SpaceX was going to die. He just doubled down. Now he's the richest man on Earth. Now that could have gone one or two ways. And he could have, you know, fate could have just put him, and he would have been fucked, and he would have been destitute, and he would have had no money.
Yeah.
But he's Elon Musk. He'd come back. He'd find one of his rich friends. He'd go, hey, man, I got a really cool idea. They'd be like, yeah, bro, we know that you've achieved this and this before. I'm going to put my money on that racehorse, and he's probably going to win again.
Yeah.
Because the investor knows that racehorse has got that tenacity and that flair in them to be able to keep going until they win. But not many people are that obsessed or that – most people don't have the mindset to take all the knocks on the head that come with great achievement. It's a gift and a curse. And sometimes I wish that I could accept mediocrity and just go and have a 9-to-5 job and have a wife and kids and just be normal. It'd be a much easier life. But that's not the way that I was born, and that's not the way that I'm going to die either. It is. Everything's a gift and a curse.
Yep. It's balance. You know, I like the analogy of putting your nuts on the chopping block and see what happens, because eventually your nuts will be so big and tough that the guillotine won't cut through them, you know, so.
100%. Be made of diamond and break the hammer. But at the same time, you also have to understand that every single person on the planet has problems, whether it's Elon Musk and obviously money does fix a lot of problems. But look at Steve Jobs. He was, you know, one of the richest people in the world at the time, and he died of cancer. And, you know, did he waste his life? You know, that's a matter of opinion, you know, that you can't walk a mile in someone else's shoes. It's just not possible. We've all got our own problems. You just got to play it as it lies.
Yep.
As Happy Gilmore had to in that movie.
Speaking of that, they're about to do a second one. I don't know if you saw that. He's got a script.
I eat pieces of shit like you for breakfast.
Do you eat shit for breakfast,
Shooter?
No. No, that's a great, just a great speech for everybody that's listening, that you got to keep going, whether it's cannabis or any other topic or sports, filmmaking, whatever it is. That's all you have is your will to keep going. And so
we've all got the same 24 hours in the day. And just because someone else got dealt a better card than you this week, you know, maybe next week they'll get a wild joker, you know, like it is what it is, man. Like it is what it is. Some people are going to have an easy time getting in and they've got more talent than you. That's the way that the cookie crumbles. You can cry about it and be like, oh my God, you poor me. That victim mentality didn't get anybody anywhere. You just got to get on with it. And that's easy for me to say that, you know, like in my position, the people that I've grown up around, you know, I was blessed. I am blessed, but I was blessed with what I was blessed with. And it would be a disservice to my ancestors that have built the platform that I get to build off, if I didn't do something with what was given to me.
As well said.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense.
You can't judge people on the card that they're dealt, whether you're the billionaire's kid or the pauper's kid. You know, Franklin fucking Amstead Rothschild was born in a ghetto in Vienna. By the time he was dead, he controlled the world in one generation. So if he can do it, there's a likelihood that you potentially can do it too. So again, I can only play the card that I'm dealt, and you can only play the card that you're dealt. And a lot of people will probably say, oh, that, you know, that little rich white kid from Australia, blah, 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 blah. And that's fine. They're allowed to say whatever the fuck they want to say. But at the end of the day, I was drawn the card that I was drawn, and you're drawn the card that you're drawn. And that's life. And you work hard. If you were in a detrimental place, you know, a lot of people that have come from nothing, you know, they're trying to build a legacy so that their kids have a better platform to build than they had. And that's what my dad did. And that's what my grandfather did. You know, it is what it is.
Yep.
That's the way life, that's the way the cookie crumbles.
You can't choose where you're born, who you're born to, your situation. All you can do is make the best of what you got.
And it's the same with, you know, what's something that I'm trying to deal with at the moment. Again, same ramifications with the Utah story. You know, COVID, wasn't allowed to travel. Then I was put on bail for, you know, projecting cannabis leaves on the Sydney Opera House. These are ramifications of my own actions. I have to deal with these ramifications. But how I deal with them and how I react to them, it's my own choice, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's been a long journey. Like, now I can't drive. So I'm stuck in the hills, frustrated as fuck. I can't surf all the time. I've got to get lifts places. I've got to spend, you know, I probably spent $3,000 on Ubers in the last 6 weeks. You know, that it all adds up. But that's the ramifications of my actions, which is that's a fucking hard pill to swallow. But then a lot of other people in the world, which I must give kudos to, you know, a lot of people are born with disabilities. A lot of poor people are born with no money, or they're, you know, they're a certain color or race or ethnicity in a country where they get vilified. I can't understand the trials and tribulations that they've had to overcome in order to be able to achieve greatness. And I tip my hat and take my hat off to these kind of people that have done that. But it has been done in the past, and it can be done again. There's a million people in history that have overcome a lot more adversity than I'm ever going to face and achieved much greater things than I've achieved so far.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put a tip on what I've achieved, because that would be blasphemy.
Yeah.
But you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, you're still in the process. So, you know, to be, you know, more coming down the road. And, you know, it with, like you mentioned, the state of America, and you know, when things are going crumbling, it's very easily to quit, go in a hole and hide, and not, like you said, kind of run away.
Enjoy the process, man. It's the same with like acting. One of my friends was a prominent actor here in Australia. He was on a big TV show. He moved to the States. He got Heath Ledger's agent. He was, you know, prominently going to probably be, you know, on his way to being an A-list movie star. He went to 100 auditions before he got his first job. Now, I wouldn't say he's an A-list actor, but he's a working actor. He's a millionaire. He's been in, you know, he was a lead in Letters to Juliet. He was a lead in Aragon. He was, you know, he's had four or five TV shows where he's been the lead actor. Nice. You know, and he killed it. But he put on, he worked his ass off here in Australia. He stacked his cash. He moved halfway around the world. But he enjoyed the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he enjoyed the process, which is something it's very difficult. Or you can take the other route, which is the route that I take, like Seth Rogen and you know, all that crew. They just said fuck it, or what Sylvester Stallone did. They just, you know, wrote make their own script, shit. Put themselves in their own movie.
Now, I did the same thing. I'm an
advocate of that more.
Yeah,
but it depends on which way. You know, that direction, the corporate direction, requires a lot of dick sucking and a lot of gatekeepers that you got to jump through.
That's
not necessarily for me, but at the same time, that if you put on for yourself, then you're responsible for your own outcomes, which is a very difficult thing to swallow when things don't go your way, as they've recently, you know, I've gone through a lot of trials and tribulations to be able to get where I'm trying to go, you know,
mm-hmm.
But that's part of the it's a really difficult sometimes. And you look up at the fucking roof and you're lying in bed and you're like, you know, you're fucking lonely and you got no money and you spent all your money on creating this content and doing this and that. And you're like, fuck, what am I doing with my life? And I have moments like that all the fucking time. Mm-hmm. Will I have moments like that once I break through and get really rich? Probably. I reckon A-list movie stars have the same moments.
Yep. I've talked to them and I know they do. Similar story as your friend, hundreds of auditions to get one little small role that will lead to another role that will lead to another role. And you got to love what you do. And the only thing that keeps you going is your passion and your drive. And
you're lucky to have a passion, man. You're lucky to wake something up. A lot of people live their life and have no passion and have no reason to get up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my very good friends, his family are worth $2 or $3 billion. And he's an awesome guy. But he said to me a couple of times when I've been hanging out with him, he's like, bro, I'm fucking bored. He doesn't have any, he doesn't have to want for anything. Everything's provided for him. And he's like, I'm trying to find something to stoke me out to the point of obsession like you've got, because what you've got is contagious. So if you have an obsession with snowboarding or skateboarding or acting or whatever it is, fuck, that's a blessing in itself that you've got something to have a reason to wake up, because a lot of the population don't have that.
Yeah, that's a great way to, in a way, kind of wrap this up, because that's what I love talking about with people like yourself and in the cannabis community, because it's very apparent that every cannabis connoisseur, activist, or advocate that I've talked to has said from the moment they tried it, they knew that the plant was more than just something to them. You know, it's part of their life. It heals. A study just came out that said cannabis enhances empathy in people. So everybody that advocates for the plant is passionate and they love it. And they do it because they love it and they want to help other people. So that would be a perfect place to kind of put a button on it. And I know you got some stuff to do. It's, you know, days starting there. What, it's still Saturday?
Yeah, it's Sunday, actually.
Sunday.
Tomorrow. We're ahead of you guys. It's 8 a.m. on Sunday morning. Daylight savings just ended. It must have ended this morning. Yep.
Nice.
Daylight savings ended. So I just gained an hour. I lost. Did I lose? No. I gained. I don't know. Anyways.
So I'm really talking the future right now. This is cool.
You are talking to the future.
This is
just as a closing statement, you know, like anyone that wants to see change in the universe, instead of being like all these fence sitters that just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and have all these inflated opinions, instead of being a victim to your own, you know, to your own circumstances, you know, pull up your bootstraps and go make shit happen, because one day you're going to be on your deathbed and you're going to look back on your life and you go, fuck, I wish that I did when I didn't. Mm-hmm. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Like, go out there and make shit happen, live your life,
mm-hmm.
love, lose, make money, lose money, you know, get arrested, whatever it is that you need to do, but go live your life, because one day we're not going to be here. And, you know, you want to remember the things that you did, not the things that you didn't do.
Well said. I won't say anything after that except get off the fence, keep growing, and don't forget to tip your bud tenders. This was an amazing chat. I'd love to have you in Austin as soon as you're able to travel.
I can travel now, so I'll be there after I do this money raise next week. I'll probably be in the States in the next probably hopefully 8 to 10 weeks if I'm allowed, because okay. I do have a pending potential criminal conviction because of my drug driving, which is something that we really need to change in Australia. So
yeah,
that's our next big thing. Check us out. Follow me on Willie's World 69, Willie's World podcast. I'd love to have you on my podcast. Follow the Craze Co, Craze Collective, and check out Who Are We Hurting. We're doing another stunt in about 2 weeks on the 20th of April in Melbourne. I wouldn't say it's a game-changing event, but it'll definitely make a mark. And write into your local politicians. Be the change that you want to see. You know, lobby, activist, protest, make shit happen, because you've only got one life to live. And if you want to change things, instead of talking shit and being like the fence sitter, go out and make shit happen.
Hey, hear, hear. I second everything you just said. I appreciate you for coming on. I'd love to be on your show anytime. Give me a shout. And we'll do this again. And in about, 8 to 10 weeks or whenever you can, we'll get you out on Lake Austin on a boat and go have some fun.
Awesome. Sounds awesome. We'll go wakeboarding.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's awesome. Oh, man. Now I want to go do that. So, hey, thanks a lot for the chat.
Blow my dad again doing a backside rodeo wake to wake. Fuck yeah, that'll be fun.
Hey. We'll make some.
And then I'll have a $50,000 bill from the U.S. Medical Service for my knee.
Yeah, just for the brace. That's it, just for the brace. It'd be $50,000.
Just for the brace. Thanks very much for your time, guys. Enjoy.
Thanks. Cheers.